Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. And folks, we are starting this pod the exact same way we've started five other ones this year. Scottie Scheffler is a winner on the PGA Tour, prevailing in a playoff against Tom Kim at the Travelers Championship, where a par on the first extra hole was enough to win in a tournament that was marred briefly, Rex, by some protesters on the 72nd green. What is your reaction to this latest Scottie signature W?
I mean, this one seemed like it was a little bit more difficult than maybe, and maybe this is just looking from 30,000 feet. And I do find it amazing that when we talk about Scottie Scheffler, we kind of talk about the guy that doesn't show a lot of emotion, that seems to be a bit of a robot when he's on the golf course. And I kind of saw something different this afternoon. Like when he finally putts out, it was almost exhaustion, relief. You could tell, like, this one seemed like it took a toll for some reason, more so than maybe the other ones did. And I'm not quite sure why. Maybe it's just the playoff and the uncertainty of it all, or the situation that he's in after Pinehurst. We talked a lot about that. But there was emotion there, and then it immediately swung. I did like the fact that as soon as his wife and Bennett baby Bennett started coming down the hill, that he just lit up. So I love the idea that we get to see at least a sliver of emotion when it comes to this. But the performance, like, I just kind of went on just to look at his stats for the week, and it's everything you would expect. He's top five in everything. I mean, strokes gained driving, strokes gained tee to green, strokes gained approach, scrambling, even putting. He picked up 2.5 strokes. I mean, everything that he needs to do well, he did well this week. And it's come, I don't want to say it's a broken record, because I do enjoy watching it. I think it is an enjoyable brand of golf, but man, this is getting familiar.
I think there's something to be said for the exhaustion level. This was the third week in a row. The two prior weeks were incredibly physically demanding golf courses, whether it's Muirfield Village and Scottie Scheffler won that golf tournament, 8 under par, a very hard-earned victory in another signature event. Obviously, the U.S. Open, Scottie finished T41 there. Like, that was by far his worst performance. You can only imagine the mental exhaustion that he was experiencing that week, not playing his best golf, trying to figure out why he was not playing his best golf. And then coming to the Travelers Championship, an entirely different test, a golf course at TBC River Highlands that asks entirely different questions than Muirfield Village or Pinehurst did. And yet Scottie Scheffler still wins. But I do think from a physical standpoint, from a mental standpoint, from a mental standpoint, from an emotional standpoint, this was exhausting on many levels. I think the weirdness of the emotion was Scottie Scheffler going head to head against Tom Kim. And Scottie just turned 28. Tom Kim just turned 22. They have not been shy in their admiration and respect for one another. Scottie and his entire family, his parents as well, have really taken Tom Kim under their wings, tried to show him the ropes. The tour can be a very lonely place, especially for a player like Tom Kim, who besides Akshay Bhatia, another 22-year-old, is not really filled with players who are at their lot in life that Tom Kim currently is. And Sky talked afterward about the conflicting emotions of wanting to do well. He's in the midst of this historic season on the PGA Tour. He's as competitive as of a person as they come. And yet he felt at least somewhat conflicted doing so, sort of at the expense of a player who he is spending a lot of time with, both at home at Dallas and the PGA Tour where he's playing practice. So I think that was sort of the difference of emotions. But I don't think it's any less satisfying for Scottie Scheffler to get his sixth victory of the season.
Were you surprised the playoff played out the way it did? I mean, Tom Kim looked like he was on cruise control. I think he'd outdriven, well, he'd hit driver on the first playoff hole and Scottie had hit 3-wood, but there was a 50-yard difference between the two. And it just seems to me, I don't know if he misjudged the wind. I think at the time, Trevor Immelman on the broadcast said the wind died as soon as he hit the shot, but it was a really bad shot.
That was a really, really bad shot with a lob wedge from 111, basically hitting like high toey shot that plugged in a bunker. Like, the tournament was over at that point. To your first question, like, I never thought at any point on Sunday that Scottie Scheffler was not going to win this golf tournament. It did not matter who was beginning to factor in the proceedings. It was Xander Schauffele early, and then he sort of faded. It was Tony Finau, and then he hit it in the water late on the par three. Patrick Cantlay was making a run. Akshay made his run. Tom Hoge got in the house early with a 62. Sungjae at least posted 20 under par. Tom Kim playing in the final group with him, like, was sort of matching him shot for shot. But at no point did you actually think that Scottie Scheffler was going to lose this golf tournament. And I think that's where it's different from some of the more dominant players that we've seen, let's call it, over the past decade or so. They have all had some sort of flaw where, you know, Rory, you know, like a wedge is going to pop up and bite him. Jordan could literally do anything back in his heyday from 2015, 2016, 2017, where like you just knew that he was sort of dancing on a razor's edge. Justin Thomas was and is a very streaky putter. John Rahm is prone to emotional outbursts. DJ could probably have some sort of boneheaded decision that was going to lose him the golf tournament. What's Scottie Scheffler's like fatal flaw? Like he's so predictable. And I've said this phrase so many times in this podcast, like he has such a predictable range of outcomes where he's not going to blow up. He's not going to hit it in the water. He's going to play the smart conservative shot. He's most likely not going to three putt from some range that he shouldn't. He's not going to just all of a sudden start missing big with any of his irons. Like he does not have the big miss in him. He's the best iron player and he is hitting it closest to the center of the fairway. So like he's the straightest driver of the golf ball, particularly his length. He's the best iron player. Like what is his flaw going to be? That's why you have Sundays like this where it feels like he's never going to lose.
I mean, the easiest answer to that is to get arrested in one of the most bizarre scenes we've ever seen in the major championship. But it may still be too soon for him because I don't think he's still
Detective Brian Gillis and Just Stop Oil protesters are the only thing that could potentially stop him.
Yeah, that's the and the protesters didn't even stop him. They just got some paint on the green. To your point, I think you're right. This is a dominant player who is in such a full run. And I'll go back because I think we kind of went back and forth a little bit on what happened at Pinehurst and the idea that maybe he was exhausted. I think that factors into it as well. But I still go back to the idea that he simply wasn't prepared. And I think for that specific golf course, the test, the questions he was going to get asked, he just wasn't ready for that. He had to play out of the wild areas. He got put into some difficult situations and didn't perform. You're right. It doesn't happen on a golf course like TPC River Highlands or Muirfield Village or Bay Hill or TPC Sawgrass. I can keep going down the list. It was a very, very specific one-off. And like spinning it forward, I can only imagine. I don't think he signed up for the Scottish Open. I think they said during the telecast his next start was going to be the Open Championship at Royal Troon. I don't know. We're going to have the exact same conversation. I think we've regurgitated at least three times and probably more than that, that he's going to be in his own category. And the only thing that's going to beat him is another bizarre traffic stop or if somehow, some way, he shows up unprepared. I just don't think that happens again.
I want to amend my previous statement. Detective Brian Gillis, Just Stop Oil protesters, although they were not successful in this circumstance, and Donald Ross golf courses, which is what Pinehurst was and has been restored since by Corin Crenshaw. Like, and this is not an indictment of, I think, PGA Tour courses. Like, this is kind of what they've established over the past couple of decades. But, like, that golf course, I'm talking about Pinehurst number two, asked such interesting questions of players that they don't get asked the other 51 weeks a year. You know, you had Scottie Scheffler even admitted, you know, a little bit of hesitancy on the tee boxes, not wanting to play from those native sandy areas. There was so much mystery, the randomness that you would find in some of the lies. And I know Brandel Chamblee talked about it with Scottie Scheffler, Bryson DeChambeau coming down the stretch on that Sunday, like some of the fortuitous breaks that he was getting in what could be very penal wire grass. The number of shots that we saw repelled from the greens that you think were, if not average shots, maybe even above average shots that would wind up in very dastardly places. The sort of creativity and imagination that the players would have to show on and around the greens. Like they don't face that week in and week out on the PGA Tour. That's not to take away anything from what Scottie Scheffler has done this year. You know, TPC Sawgrass, Augusta National, Bay Hill, Muirfield Village, TPC River Highlands, Harbortown, like those are all, if not the most challenging, at least in the top tier. Like those are four signature events, a major, and the tournament that's widely considered a fifth major in golf. Like those are the best tests that they face on the PGA Tour. But I do think it's worth considering that the PGA Tour, if it wants to expand its product, if it wants to, I think, make for more interesting viewing, it's to find better golf courses that better test some of the players than what we're seeing sort of year in and year out at a Travelers Championship, particularly if it's going to be a signature event. Like, you know exactly what you're going to get. The winning score is going to be 17 to 24 under par. It's going to be soft. It's going to be short. Guys are going to be hitting driver flip wedges into 18 as Tony Finau did on Sunday. To me, that's not always going to identify the best golfer. It tends to be more often than not a little bit of a putting contest.
I looked up the toughest golf courses on the PGA Tour this year. So Pinehurst is number one, but right behind it's Augusta National, Muirfield Village, Quail Hollow is fifth. Keep going down the list.
Torrey's got to be up there always.
Torrey and Bay Hill. So those are all places he had success on. I see what you're saying about Pinehurst, and I'm with you. I think Pinehurst is such a distinct and wonderful test. That's the reason why it's going to be the venue that we go back to every 10 years. It's the one we're always going to look forward to. It's for all the reasons we talked about during that championship. I don't know that the case study is big enough. I'm sitting here trying to think off the top of my head how many Don Ross courses there are in the PGA Tour that they play on the PGA Tour. I think Sedgefield is one, which would be, I don't know how.
He's always going to skip that one. It's the week before the FedEx Cup playoff opener. I think
Plainfield for the playoff event, that was probably one of them. I don't know what his record is there. And I agree with you 100%. I mean, we had this conversation when they rolled the golf ball back. And I have argued that, yes, there's probably something that needed to be done equipment-wise, but you can also do something architecture-wise, because one of the most difficult and one of the most intriguing, one of the most entertaining holes on the PGA Tour all year long is the 10th hole at Riviera. And it's a 340-something yard par four that just gets inside players' heads and forces them to make decisions that they don't want to make. I think that's what Pinehurst did. Like, all day long, for 18 holes, you're forced to make decisions that you simply don't want to make. And that was kind of a blind spot for Scotty at that moment in time. I think some other stuff probably factored into it as well. I think getting over what happened at Valhalla, I think having the baby, all the things we talked about before. But yeah, Pinehurst as a test was clearly something he wasn't ready for.
Like, what are you going to remember from this 3 week stretch? Are you going to remember Scotty's taut victory at Muirfield Village? Are you going to remember his narrow playoff victory over Tom Kim at the Travelers Championship? Or are you going to remember the fact that Scotty looked a little bit bewildered and befuddled, shooting four consecutive rounds over par at the U.S. Open when he came in as the prohibitive favorite? What sort of singular event among that 3 week stretch are you going to remember most at the end of the year?
I'm going to remember Bryson DeChambeau winning the U.S. Open at Pinehurst.
I'm talking specifically.
Literally and figuratively.
I'm talking specifically about Scottie Scheffler. Of that three-week stretch, what are you going to remember most? For me, it's going to be remembering his no-show at the U.S. Open when I thought that was a golf course that was tailor-made for him.
And everyone said it was going to be a perfect golf course for him. Even people that weren't inside his camp recognized that golf course as a ball striker's golf course. This should be Scottie by a million miles. You're right. That's the one that stands out, which is kind of weird because it's sandwiched between two pretty impressive victories at signature events. But no, you're right on that one. But to be fair to Bryson, I'm going to remember Bryson running around. And to a lesser degree, Johnson Wagner being a really good second shot golfer.
I mean, and this is not to discount, again, what Scottie Scheffler is doing. I still don't think that the general public is completely grasping what we're witnessing here in terms of Scottie Scheffler's dominance. Like, the first player since Arnold Palmer in 1962 to win six times on the PGA Tour before July 1st. He's the first player since Tiger Woods to even win six times in a season. You know, all we've heard is that this crop of tour players is stronger and deeper than ever before, and that it's so hard to separate in today's era because of equipment advances that have sort of leveled the playing field. But he is blowing away the competition from a strokes gained perspective. And the consistent excellence that he is putting out almost week in and week out. Like, I think we've seen it now on the women's side with Nelly Korda, where she won six of seven events. Everyone's losing their minds. And now she has missed three consecutive cuts, two of which have come in the major championships. When it comes to Sky, like, this is not a hot streak. This is not a burst. Like, at this point, I think if you're a golf fan, you want to see just how deep Scottie Scheffler can take this. Like, you want to see history. You want to see him improve on his career record at the Open Championship. You want to see him win a gold medal at the Olympics. You want to see him rip off two wins and three starts in the FedEx Cup playoffs and finally get, for the first time, a FedEx Cup title. We're at that point in the season where anything other than like another win or two is going to feel like a disappointment for Sky. Like, we want to see those Tiger-esque peak Tiger years of 2000, 02, 06, 07, Tiger's at his absolute best, 09, like at his absolute best. That's what you want to see. And that's going to require 7, 8, 9 wins against this deep crop of players.
I was having a conversation with a friend of mine today about this, and I have come to the conclusion, and I've kind of bounced back and forth on the idea that golf is at its best when you have a dominant player. And that was easy when Tiger Woods was the dominant player, and he did it for more than two decades. And it's because within that dominant player, you also had the variances of some people loved him and some people didn't love him. So you had everything built into one person. You had what made fandom so special, which makes sports so enjoyable, because you need to have sort of that dichotomy. With Scottie Scheffler, we have that dominant player. There's no two ways around it. Like I think the facts are on the ground. They're in the stats. You pointed out the one that stood out to me. They said it on the telecast, was he has earned, and I never go back to FedEx Cup points, especially at this point in the season, but he's earned more FedEx Cup points than number two and number three on the list combined. And that, I believe that's Xander and Rory McIlroy. And
he's still just going to get a two-shot head start.
That's not going to feel great. The difference with Scotty is he's not polarizing in not even iota, not even the least. I mean, I can go down the list of other players if he was in this position. If Rory was in this position and doing these things, Rory has become, over the last 2 and 3 years, very, very polarizing. Like, it would be very, very entertaining. Xander, to maybe a certain degree, would be a little polarizing, just because you have sort of that internal camp of Xander and Patrick Cantlay being friends, and it seems like Rory and Tiger on the other side. You can keep going down the list. If it was Bryson playing on the PGA Tour right now, I think he'd be just as polarizing. Scotty's just not. He's enjoyable to watch. Again, I really like the brand of golf, but I'm praying for the chaos at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst for him to win, because I want to watch greatness, and it's enjoyable. But also, you want the subtext of being like, we're going to end up getting the Royal Troon, and the only thing that's going to separate Scottie Scheffler from the single-season Grand Slam is a detective named Brian Gillis. Is that really what we're going to do? Like, that's just shocking to me. So it's fun to watch. It's amazing when you start laying out the stats. When you look at what he's done this season, and we thought last year it was an impressive season, strokes gained total, strokes gained balls, tee to green. This year's going to be even better if he continues at this clip.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think what's missing from this year, and when you think back to the Tiger era, and obviously he had a certain level of charisma that we had not seen since probably Arnold Palmer, but Tiger also had, through that sort of decade to 12-year run, a number of foils, whether it was Phil Mickelson, those Ernie Els, Vijay Singh, Retief Goosen. Like, these were players who would pop up and nab theirs and push Tiger to the limits, which I think only sort of underscored just how amazing he was. Because he were players who I think in any other era would have probably been generational talents or viewed as one of the best of all time. And yet Tiger stunted their growth in unimaginable ways because he was just so dominant. So I think what we're missing from this year is a player who has sort of consistently threatened Scotty ever since he sort of elevated to this level at the beginning of 2023. Like, Ludvig Åberg could very well be that player. Yet he just has one victory on the PGA Tour. Wyndham Clark looked like he might be that player. Had things gone a little bit differently at the Players Championship, like, you're looking at a player who had knocked off a major, a couple signature wins as well. Instead, he's sort of fallen flat.
It feels Xander, like it's going to be Xander.
Xander Schauffele feels like he could be that player, consistently excellent, but he just picked off his first major championship as well. That's his lone victory in 2024. Is it Rory? He's 35 years old. Obviously, the scar tissue is just mounting in the major championships, as well as we saw at Pinehurst. That, to me, is what's been lacking over these past 2 years. And the bummer, Rex, the disappointment, is that I think a lot of people, myself included, thought John Rahm could be that guy. If you saw the back and forth between Scottie Scheffler and John Rahm, at least in the first 6 months of the 2023 season, in which they combined for six total wins, including a major, including the Players, including what are now several signature events, like, that seemed to be the two players who could go head to head for the next half decade, and golf fans would sort of pick a side. It'd be great golf, two competitors who are fiercely competitive, but also have sort of a mutual respect for one another's game. Like, that to me is the piece that's missing in this certain sector. Again, that's not to take anything away from Scotty, but I think that could even elevate his greatness a little bit more, just as it did with Tiger's heyday.
Well, and I think I've said this before, but I always felt like golf was at its best when during Tiger Woods' era, when he was in his prime. Golf was at its best when Phil Mickelson was at his best, for the points you just pointed out. Because when Phil Mickelson was at his best, not only did you have someone pushing Tiger, and clearly they didn't like each other. They had history there. Like, it was fun. There was beef involved there, even if they didn't really address it publicly. The other half of it is you had sort of the fandom with a very, very fine line between either you're a Tiger guy or you were a Phil guy. And that made everything better. And they very, very rarely went head-to-head on a Sunday, let alone in a major championship. Like, it just didn't happen very often. But when it did, it was special. I remember the year at Doral when it wasn't a WGC yet. I think it was the Ford Championship back then. And they were paired the last pairing together. And it was a scene that you only see at a Ryder Cup or at a major championship, because the first tee was just packed. There was so much excitement. Again, either you were a Tiger guy or you were a Phil guy. And it felt like, as much as we talk about golf all the time, wanted to be a mainstream sport, that to me was one of those moments when it felt like truly a mainstream sport.
Rex, the Travelers Championship was the last signature event on the PGA Tour schedule. Now that we have a large enough sample size in 2024, they were renamed. What were they last year? What were they?
Elevated events.
That's right. I'm sure there'll be a different title for them in 2025. Maybe. What is your take on them? Was it a... Do you think it was a home run? Was it a stand-up double? Was it a sort of a weak pop-up single that falls? Or was it just a little dribbler to the pitcher that was easily handled?
We're going to continue with that metaphor. I'll go with a can of corn. Maybe is that the way you want to do? Just continue with the twisted baseball metaphors. Going back and looking, and I remember us having this conversation early in the season, because the first two winners were at the Century, it was Chris Kirk, and then at Pebble Beach, it was Wyndham Clark. And I think both of us felt underwhelmed. Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think the feeling was we wanted better. We wanted the stars. And then slowly they sort of surfaced. Again, Scotty won four of them, so it's kind of hard to differentiate between Scotty's dominant year and what the signature events did. I will say that what the tour tried to accomplish here is getting the top players together more often, playing on these classic venues. It was accomplished, because I think I was reading in the memo last week from the PGA Tour, them sort of addressing field size. On average, I think they had one player miss each one, which is pretty good when you consider how many players could potentially not want to play that. I think Rory missing last week, missing the Travelers, made perfect sense. But it drew all the top players together without making it mandatory. And that was a really, really difficult thing for the tour to do. And I know most people kind of rolled their eyes when they thought about it. Well, last year, the elevated slash designated events slash whatever you want to call them, they were essentially mandatory if you wanted to get your PIP money. Rory Forgo gave up some of his because he didn't play in his minimum number. However, this time around, they didn't put any requirements on it at all. The only requirement was you were going to get a lot more money, much bigger purses, and a lot more FedEx Cup points. And it worked. So I think on that level, it was, I'm going to go stand-up double. We'll just continue with the analogy. The other side of it is, though, and this is going to continue to look into it, I think we can all agree, or I think most of us can agree, that 70-player fields just don't work. They feel contrived. They feel too small. They feel like you're not giving the customer enough for a bigger bang for his buck. I think 120, 100 even, whatever the case may be, gives you a better sample size. I also... I'm really, really curious to see how we end up at the end of the season, because according to the memo that was sent to players last week from the tour, that the quote unquote churn rate, you guys looked that up. Essentially, it's the number of players that fall in to the top 50 and fall out of the top 50 year over year, right now is right on pace to where they want it to be. However, I think when we crunch those numbers at the end of the year, that's not going to be the case, because I think statistically you had players playing no cut events for dramatically more points. I don't know how that works out.
Yeah. That churn rate they wanted was 35%, yeah. I believe, based on the talks at the Players' Championship. In other words, that's a 65% retention rate. Everyone else is sort of cycling in and out. To your point, like the first three signature event winners, Chris Kirk, Wyndham Clark, and what was a range-shortened event at Pebble Beach, and then Hideki Matsuyama at the Genesis Invitational. All very nice players in Hideki's case and Wyndham's case, both major champions. But I think the dialogue heading into the Arnold Palmer Invitational is, where's the stars? And all that's happened since then was Scotty at Bay Hill, Scotty at the Players, Scotty at RBC Heritage, Rory at the Wells Fargo, which Scotty did not play because he just welcomed his first child, Scotty at Memorial, and then Scotty at the Travelers Championship. To some people, that's going to be boring as well. I'm with you that I think the signature event series was a stand-up double, but I don't think it's ever possible for it to be a home run. If we're just going to continue this, the reason I say so is because I don't think they've necessarily identified the best events to be a signature event. Like, I think having the RBC Heritage instead of the RBC Canadian Open is a big swing and a miss. That continues to be one of the most well-attended, most energetic, best atmospheres of a PGA Tour event year in and year out, and yet it does not have that sort of designated status. I would love to see the very best players in the world at a national open. I think that would elevate it to other levels. I also think, Rex, like, if you're the PGA Tour, you're essentially saying these are the tournaments that matter. These are the tournaments that are guaranteed to have the stars, and everything else is basically just filler. Everything else is just building up storylines for the other signature events or for the major championships. If that's the basis for your product, I think that is a huge miss. The solution is to pare this down to make it 20 events. 20 events, they should all essentially be signature events that have huge purses and the best fields. I'm with you. I think probably 100 or 90 is probably a better number for these events that you can get sort of the long shot story to go up head to head against Scotty Scheffler. To me, it will never be what the tour, I think, aspires to be. But I do think sort of at the surface level, it still produced good drama. It still produced, by and large, great winners. And so I think in that respect, tour executives are probably happy with how this has turned out.
Yeah. And again, I can't overstate this. The idea that these weren't going to be mandatory and that the tour was rolling the dice to a certain degree that they were going to get the fields that they promised. So keep in mind, they're going to sponsors and asking for essentially double the payout. It was going to cost sponsors. Travelers Championship had to pay double what they did the year before when it was not a signature designated elevated event, whatever it is you want to call it. And so you're banking on the idea that for that extra money, you're going to get the PGA Tour's absolute best players at the moment. That was a bit of a leap of faith if you want to put yourself into Jay Monahan's shoes. The idea that, okay, we can't make it mandatory. Like, the players pushed back on that. They didn't want to be told exactly where to play. I'm fascinated by the idea that wherever it is we land with the negotiations with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia and the future of the game. I was having this conversation at the U.S. Open with one of the player directors. And we were kind of going back and forth on what the future could look like. And I keep coming back to the idea that if I gave you a blank sheet of paper and I said, give me your best 20 event schedule, like just lay them out, and it could be whatever number you pick, 12 events in the United States, 8 events outside the United States. And we can go back and forth until we come up with something really, really cool is what I keep kind of thinking about. And the player agreed. And yeah, we could do that. But right now they don't have a blank piece of paper. And the reason he said that is because you have existing contracts with sponsors. You have existing contracts with media partners, the television partners. You have existing contracts with golf courses. You have all of these existing deals already in place that don't end on a specific date. They all have different ending dates. And his point was, if you pull one thread, everything unravels. So I like the idea of us finally getting to a point, however many X number of years from now, where we do have a 20-event global schedule. That you end up with, let's pick 100. That's a good number. 100 of the game's best players playing together more often in these big markets on these classic golf courses where there's history in the golf course. And this is what the product is. And everything else under that is, like we've talked about it before, it's the pyramid that they have in football in Europe, where you play your way up the pyramid until someday you land in the Premier League. Well, in this case, you would land in whatever the PGA Tour Enterprises global schedule is going to be called. I love all that idea. I just don't think we're close to it yet.
And I also don't think, not to belabor this point, that the schedule of the signature events did not work this year. Like, there was
certainly not the last three events. The last three events were the worst part of it. Yeah.
But like, there's this big kickoff event at Kapalua. I've been on record saying I think that should make that more into like a Pro Bowl type kickoff event, as opposed to like trying to make this into a big signature event that's very important. Then you disappear essentially for 3 weeks during the heart of the NFL season. So whatever momentum you just built up with the kickoff event in Hawaii essentially disappears until you pop up again at Pebble Beach and one of the most recognizable venues in the world of golf. Then at that point, you have a Pebble Beach, then you have Phoenix, which is always well attended by the top players because they love the atmosphere there. And then you have Tiger Woods' event, Genesis Invitational, at one of the best golf courses, if not the best golf course in the entire PGA Tour schedule, in that sort of three in a row. Then you go to Florida after a couple of weeks that, again, the PGA Tour is essentially telling you do not matter as much as the signature events. Then you have back-to-back Bay Hill and the Players' Championship. And then at a time where you just built all this momentum through the spring, this is the entire run-up to the Masters, you disappear for 3 weeks until the year's first major. Again, that is a miss. I don't like the fact that RBC Heritage, the week after the Masters, is a signature event. I did not like the fact that the Wells Fargo Championship, the week ahead of the PGA Championship, was a signature event. I certainly, Rex, did not like what we had in this three-week stretch that just wrapped up with the Memorial Tournament, one of the most grueling tests of the year, leading into what is golf's toughest test, and then the Travelers Championship. I'm still not sold on it as a signature event on the back end. That obviously didn't work. Jack's Place will not be doing that next year. They're going back to its traditional date, the week of the Memorial. So there will be a space, a week in between the Memorial and the U.S. Open. That clearly did not work for Jack Nicklaus as well. I do think that could use some reimagining next year to have a more consistent cadence to it, where big event, full field event, big event, full field event. Like, that's what they should be trying to be leaning towards, as opposed to cramming them into certain times of the year just to squeeze them in before it gets too FedEx Cup heavy.
Well, you're also forgetting, like, the cadence of this schedule was by design. Like, they had to jump through some hoops to get it to where it is right now. They wanted specifically to have, all right, two big events. Let's say a designated event and a major, followed by two or three full field events, and then keep that cadence going. The idea being that the two, that's when the Aeon swing
10 next five.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what that was supposed to accomplish. So now you clearly don't like it. I don't know that they're going away from that. I mean, I still think that's probably in the formula. What if I had to point to one thing, it's the one you just pointed out. It's Memorial U.S. Open Travelers. It was just bad. Like, we talked the first 5 minutes about, you could see it on Scottie Scheffler's face. He was exhausted. And there was some other stuff that factored in there. But you also need to take into account that they played a lot of golf in a really, really small window. And I think everyone's going to disappear now for 2 weeks, or at least 2 weeks, before they end up going to Scotland for the Scottish Open and the Open Championship. And I do want to go on the record, because this continues to come up, speaking of going on the record, that you and I don't agree on everything. As a matter of fact, I think more times than not, we disagree. That's kind of the whole point of us being on the podcast. But we do like each other. And so I think it's important to point out that everyone who always comments that we don't like each other, that's not entirely true. We spend time together away from work. We play golf together. We'll go have dinner. We'll go have drinks. So I don't know what it is that makes people think that we don't like each other, but I can't speak for you, but I do like you.
Yeah, we're on text chains with Russ. That is very active, if not my most active text chain I have. We call each other, not all that often, but we do talk to each other outside of this 35-minute podcast.
I complain, but yes.
Yes, yeah, we're typically kvetching about something as opposed to checking up and seeing how each other's family is doing. But yes, please stop saying this in the comments. It is entirely not true. And if Rex and I give off that vibe, I believe we're playing our oppositional characters to a T, if that's the takeaway that people are going with here. You have the sausage finger. Please go ahead.
I do. And then finally, I wanted to touch on, I noticed you still have the ugly headphones on. Is there an update on the earbuds? And is Marriott on the hook for a new pair of earbuds?
They're not. Unfortunately, I have to wave the white flag in this instance. I did receive two messages from Marriott. One from a fellow named Tony J, who was with the Marriott customer care team, who basically said, shrug. I cannot help you. This is a third-party venue. Whatever nefarious thing happened in room 128, that Spring Hill Suites in Pinehurst, whatever happened in that room, we are not liable for. We are not responsible for. We will not send you those back for free, as I was asking. And so, yeah, I don't have a choice. I looked up to see how much AirPods currently cost. Like, the next gen, it's like $150 to $200. So for $37, it does seem economically more feasible for me to go out and just bring them back myself. I think the big question, Rex, is whether I can expense this reclaiming, this this collecting of what was stolen from me. Like, do you think I could run that through the Concur system with a little bit of note saying this was stolen out of room 128?
Yes, of course. Oh. We have to have earbuds to do our job. Like, I lost mine, I think, last year, and I just ordered a new pair. It's not that difficult.
Say no more. Thank you, Concur. Thank you, NBC Universal. Thank you for also buttoning up another talking point. I had the privilege and opportunity, Rex, to test out a driver that you did not have. We'll be touching on your trip to the Travelers Championship, in which you were sent a little bit of a wild goose chase. But on Thursday, I was testing out the new GT driver from Titleist. Thank you to my friends at Titleist, specifically Tina, for hooking us up here. I tested, and I think we're always, aren't we, Rex, a little bit skeptical when we see tour players raving about certain equipment, right? Like, these are very highly paid endorsers of a product. If they're saying that they're getting distance gains, if they're saying they're getting speed gains, like, I always take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. Not so for me. I'm playing the most recent generation of Titleist drivers. I gained, if you guys cannot see this, this is an audio medium for at least some of you, I gained 39 yards on average with the new driver. And I gained, I think most critically, 11 miles an hour in ball speed with the latest driver. This is not a paid endorsement. Titleist is not asking me to do this, but I'm hitting the ball longer than I have basically since I was a high schooler, which is wild to think about that has now been roughly 20 years. And so I'm now boasting a carry distance of 292, boasting a total distance on average, again, on average of 308. And so my launch angle is higher with lower speed. I'm excited to play golf again. What do you think, Rex, when you finally get tested, what sort of numbers do you think you're capable of producing?
This is the height of television, isn't it?
It is.
The graphic that I'm holding up is my phone to the thing. We're
so poor and we're so technologically strapped that we can't figure out how to put a graphic ourselves. So we've just been reduced to screenshots at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. That's impressive. I was very dubious. I didn't believe you for a moment. I didn't like you. So you can put that in the comments, because I don't believe for a moment that someone can pick up 39 yards. And so I did reach out to Tina. Tina, thank you so much. I am going for my own fitting here soon, because I have to see this firsthand for myself, because that's an amazing leap. And I talked.
I'm not short either. Like, I was averaging.
I am
nine. Like, I was pounding that.
If I picked up 39 yards, you'd be like, well, you needed to pick up 39 yards. Like, you probably needed to pick up 49 yards. But that you're not in that category. Yeah, keep going up. You're not in that category. That's the part that shocked me. Like, I just don't know it. I will say that I talked with some players and some reps last week at the Travelers Championship, and the players started to get fit into this new driver starting at Memorial. And as a rule, players will not switch to a new driver before a major championship. Like, that's just not something they would do. And it was pretty shocking, the number of guys that made the switch, because they saw very, very, not 39 yards, but relative to how far they hit it, they saw some gains as well and wanted to go with them. So kudos to you guys. Please, Tina, work me in. Please, please, please.
This is also an awkward segue, because there was one other topic that I wanted to get into before we went on
this long
tangent. No, the long hitting Bryson DeChambeau, our reigning U.S. Open champion, was in competition last week, the LIV golf event in Nashville. I must say, from clips I saw on social media, which of course would not be doctored in any sort of meaningful way, it did seem, Rex, like a very strong turnout, at least domestically, for a product that I think has struggled at times to attract the domestic audience. Do you think that was the Bryson bump? Do you think that's a LIV bump? Do you think that people are getting excited about a potential definitive agreement finally between the PGA Tour and the PIF, and this is now more palatable? What do you attribute the scenes in Nashville to this past week?
I talked to you. I talked to a player and an agent who were at the event this week, and they acknowledged that, yes, when it comes to the U.S. venues, because internationally, I think you're seeing the international crowds embrace this much more so than the U.S. crowds, for whatever reason. And we can break that down at another point. However, I think it was 100% the Bryson bump, like, just the way he handled himself on Sunday, doing, again, a physical victory lap around property, high-fiving, letting everyone touch the trophy, crawling into the bunker in darkness with our own Johnson Wagler, like, everything about it, going to New York City on Monday to do the rounds. Players don't really do that anymore, which is kind of, this goes to what we talked about last week. As equity partners, you need to make the product better. And the way you do that is you get on a plane, now a private plane, it's not like he was in the middle seat, but you get on a plane, you fly to New York City and you do the rounds, you do the media thing. And I think this is what we saw in Bryson DeChambeau over the last week is a microcosm of what can happen if you have a player that, one, is engaging, and two, is willing to go the extra mile to make sure that the product grows as long as well as his own stature.
Don't you think there was probably a curiosity factor, though, Rex? Because when Bryson DeChambeau last won a major championship in 2020, it was during COVID. Not as many people were watching. He sort of fell off, at least his game, over his past couple of years. Now that he was front and center at Pinehurst for the U.S. Open, he's wearing his Crushers logo. He's talking about sort of the benefits that he's experienced, at least personally from the live experience and having teammates, and how that has sort of energized him and allowed him to be an entertainment. Don't you think, and again, Live does not release its own viewership data, don't you think that at any point in 2024, more people were tuning in this past week to see Live, perhaps for the first time, than they have at any point? Again, you had the John Rahm debut. He had the Anthony Kim debut, which was overseas in Saudi Arabia in the middle of the night. But I think more people were probably curious to see how Bryson would play and why it has been so beneficial than any other time in 2024. It couldn't have worked out better in the schedule that Liv was playing the very next week in what was the most well-attended tournament, at least domestically so far.
Oh, no question. I think there was going to be a bounce. There was going to be a curiosity. I think anybody who watched the Open and saw the emotion, and we went over this last week, so I'm not going to touch on it again. Maybe it was performative. Maybe it wasn't. I don't really care at this point because it drew more people to golf and more people became interested because they watched and said, that guy looks like he's having fun on the golf course. I want to go try that. Going back to, you're right, when he won the Open at Wingfoot, not only was it during the pandemic, but it was also a different Bryson. Like, we've gone over this, the idea that he's matured, he's gotten older, he's more comfortable in his skin, and he's much more willing to put himself out there like he did on Sunday night at Pinehurst and on into Monday in New York City to become a celebrity. And he embraces that. And that, like, look, for all the reasons that we respect and like Scottie Scheffler, and there are a monsoon of reasons to like and respect Scottie Scheffler, that's not really in his DNA. I would never expect him to do something like that. But the opposite side is when someone is around that does want to embrace the limelight, that does like being in crowds and having his picture taken, it's only going to give a bounce to whichever tour they happen to be playing on. And I don't think you needed to look too far last week with everything that was going on at the Travelers Championship and all the different layers. The idea that you had a signature event going on in Connecticut and then you had Bryson DeChambeau playing in a live event in Nashville. I think it's fair to say that the attention of most golf fans was squarely split between those two things.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that Live Golf has been a great for Bryson DeChambeau leaning into that sort of aspect. I think the jury is still out on whether it will prove to be a great thing for John Rahm, who did play this past week in Nashville after withdrawing midway through the Live Houston event, and then of course did not tee it up at the U.S. Open because of that infection in his left foot. John Rahm did tie for third. Again, he has finished in the top 10 in every live event this year, but does not have a win. Just some housekeeping. Terrell Hatton did with the golf tournament, dominating Legion performance. Six-shot victory. Terrell Hatton's first win. I was surprised to see this in 3.5 years. Liv is off for a couple weeks before they play Valderrama the week before the Open Championship. That's going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be on Golf Today on Wednesday for a roundtable. Apparently, there must have been better roundtable, I guess, on Monday than us. Who knew? It's still free labor. We'll just be 48 hours later than we traditionally would. And of course, on Wednesday, we will also do our preview podcast for the Rocket Mortgage Classic and anything else that comes up in the interim in the golf world. But in the meantime, nbcsports.com/golf for our latest news, notes, and updates. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys on Wednesday afternoon.